This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
That was the first moment in my life where I was truly happy, because I lived years, you know, of oppression and war in Iraq and see nothing but violence. Then I go to Syria, and I remember with the first hit of the drums and the guitar and the music, the power, the beauty and the power of music that I heard, I transformed and I forgot about all the pain, all of my sadness, and I was this happy person jumping up and down and feeling nothing but happiness, you know. And that's the power of music. So this is why, you know, it's divine. This is why I love it. This is why I've done a lot for it.
Like a magic carpet which carried her to a new land, literally and metaphorically.
Tell me how you ended up in Hollywood. How did that happen?
A life of triumph over tragedy.
There are Muslims being oppressed in Iraq, you know, Sunni Muslims being displaced, hundreds of thousands of them actually in Iraq being displaced right now by the Iraqi government, and the people are quiet. There are Muslims in Chinese prison, like the Uyghur, and they're being tortured in concentration camps.
A life of courage over conformity.
When I heard it, I remember the first time I got called a Zionist by an Egyptian person. He said, "You're a Zionist." I said, "I'm not a Zionist." Like, "You're a Zionist." And I didn't know what Zionist meant, literally. So when I heard it, because I heard it my whole life, and it was like a derogatory term, and it's something awful. And this is what I was taught, you know, Zionism is like a racist movement. It hates people, it's evil, it's this and that. And I didn't understand that what Zionism was, it's simply believing Jewish people deserve to have a homeland. That's it, that's literally it.
Twice a refugee in her life, but now she'll never go back to the place of her birth. If she did head for Baghdad, she says she'd be killed on the airport tarmac or by random militia.
Yes, I'm not allowed to return to Iraq ever. I'll probably be killed in the airport. And now that, you know, the Iraqi have took away my citizenship, and now that they have criminalized, they passed this law, you know, where they criminalize anyone who has relation with Israel with death penalty. Yes, I'm dead if I ever step a foot, you know, if not by a crazy Islamist person, then it's literally by the government and by the law.
This is the story of Sara Idan, Sarai more informally, who uses her platform to push against despotism and terror.
Like, only me and Miss Israel really know what happened that day and how it happened. And it is, you know, basically she was scared to approach me, and then I was embarrassed that she was care to approach me, and I wanted to set a good example.
And it started with an Instagram photo competing as Iraq's winning entry in Miss Universe 2017. She took selfies with Adar Gandelsman, who participated alongside Sarai as Miss Israel. All hell let loose. Iraq's tourism chief gave her what for.
Like, I didn't say anything about Israel. I didn't say I support Israel. And he's like, "You still need to take it down. You're hurting the Palestinian cause." I'm like, "What?"
and the Iraqis didn't like her wearing a bikini either. And wait for this, the condition of feeling anti-Semitism, despite not even being Jewish.
Unless you're Jewish, you really don't know what goes on, you know, because only Jewish people face Jew hate. And so, you know, I never knew that, you know, such thing existed. And then when I was getting all these messages, you know, people accusing me of being secretly Jew, and, you know, because this is what they thought when they saw a picture of me and, you know, Miss Israel. And, you know, they got like all their videos on YouTube saying, I was born in Tel Aviv, I'm secretly Jew, I was trained by the Mossad, and I was placed by the CIA. The only thing was missing was the KGB.
Now that's not the first time someone said this to me in the series. I'm sure Colonel Richard Kemp will be absolutely delighted to have something in common with Miss Universe Iraq 2017. And if you're wondering about the music, it's Sarai's choice, Rachmaninoff, Symphony No. 2, Opus 27-3, Adagio, by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazi. Sarai is busy as a human rights campaigner. She has her own podcast too, the Sarai Talk Show. And I finally caught up with her, conducting the interview at midnight my time, direct to her home in California.
Also, my public name is Sarai, I feel like, because it's more memorable than Sarah Idan. It's longer, you know, and Sarai... Like, this is why I called my, you know, podcast Sarai. I'm like, that's better than Sarah Idan.
Sarai Talk Show, indeed. Yeah. Well, welcome to Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you for thinking of me.
Well, born and raised in Baghdad, renowned human rights campaigner, Miss Universe, Iraq 2017, and self-proclaimed Zionist. You have an extraordinary story. And a life which seems to have gathered pace ever since you took a few selfies with Adar Gandelsman, who participated alongside you as Miss Israel at Miss Universe in 2017. The rest, as they say, is history. This last 6 years for you, Sarai, have been, they've been off the scale.
Yes, yes. It's been very interesting, crazy at times, but I love it. I love, you know, like, it was definitely a blessing in disguise, everything that happened. You know, in the beginning, I thought this would be the end of my career, of my life. But then I discovered that, you know, there is even more meaningful work that I could do than just being in a beauty pageant, and which is, you know, trying to bring people together. And, you know, the more and more I dealt with anti-Semitism and with Jew hate, the more I really felt connected and I wanted, like, to make a difference. Because, you know, I think unless you're Jewish, you really don't know what goes on, you know, because only Jewish people face Jew hate. And so, you know, I never knew that, you know, such thing existed. And then when I was getting all these messages, you know, people accusing me of being secretly Jew, and, you know, because this is what they thought when they saw a picture of me and, you know, Miss Israel. And, you know, they got like all their videos on YouTube saying, I was born in Tel Aviv, I'm secretly Jew, I was trained by the Mossad, and I was placed by the CIA. The only thing was missing was the KGB.
But this is the most extraordinary thing. You're talking about experiencing anti-Semitism, but you're not Jewish. You are you are a Muslim. You are from Baghdad.
Born and raised.
Your father is from Babylon, and you know there is a massive Babylonian Jewish tradition, but there's also a Babylonian history of persecution of Jewish people. So for you to have gone on this journey, is this is what I'm trying to get to understand Sarai. You talk about imbibing the idea of anti-Semitism from a Jewish perspective, but from the outside, this is fascinating to me.
I don't know, listen, here's the thing, I, to be honest with you, before this, I haven't heard about Jew hate. Yes, I grew up in Iraq. We were taught Israel is the enemy. And yes, we were taught also in Islam. We had, crazy Islamist, Jew hatred going on in our religion as well. And I never met a Jewish person before until I came to the United States. And so when I remember the first person that I met was actually Iraqi Jewish family. And, and they told me about how they got kicked out of Iraq and all of that. And I thought it was crazy because, they didn't teach us that in school. And no one talks about it as if we never had, over 200,000 Iraqi Jews in our country. So all of that, that history, that part that was hidden, it makes it hard to understand where the Jewish people, where they come from and all of that. And I think, basically when I was dealing with all the Jew hate, when I was dealing with people, telling me Hitler should have finished the job and calling me a dirty Jew and saying I'm cursed by God, all of that. This is when I started to see the craziness. And then the more and more, when I went to Israel on my first trip with American Jewish Committee, I got so much hate and was, directed at Israel and about the conflict. And then I understood more and more. The more hate that I got, the more I understood the root cause of it. And to me, it was, unjustified. The hate was unjustified. The reason was unjustified. And I wanted to try to find common ground and try to bring Muslims and Jews together, because after all, we're really not that different. Our religion is very similar. It's in so many ways. And that's the sad part.
Indeed, there are great similarities. And when I look at the Muslim people that I grew up with, and indeed, my new friends in the Gulf, thank God for the Abraham Accords, I'm finding that there is a great commonality. But let me ask, did you expect there to be such a huge reaction to that simple photograph that seemed to be the catalyst for your
absolutely
next life?
Absolutely not. And, that's the thing, when I remember this and when I talk, only me and Miss Israel really know what happened that day and how it happened. And it is, basically she was scared to approach me. And then I was embarrassed that she was scared to approach me. And I wanted to set a good example. That's all there to it. And I wasn't really thinking in that moment, because they kept us really busy. We were waking up at 5:30 in the morning. We were out, the Miss Universe, we were out at 7 a.m. rehearsing, taking photos, doing photo shoots and meeting with people and doing activities and filming. And everything was moving so quickly. The time was moving so quickly. And when I took the photo with her, I just took it. I posted it. I didn't we literally had no time to look at our social media, but we had to post, because people were waiting for us to post. So, the minute, whenever I find a minute to post, I will post. And then I don't even check my social media. And I went to sleep without checking my social media. And I woke up to the rage, of the people and what they were saying and the death threats and the Miss Iraq organization and all the craziness, And yeah, I would say it was, it happened. I don't know. I think it was really God's work. Everything, it happened. It was in such a rush manner. And I didn't really think it through. And then I will not lie to you. I was scared when I saw all the reaction. And I was doubting myself. I was thinking, did I do something wrong? But then because of the hate that I was getting and because of the, I remember I was talking with the director of the Miss Iraq organization and just saying, I did nothing wrong. It was just a photo with Miss Israel. I didn't say anything about Israel. I didn't say I support Israel. And he's you still need to take it down. You're hurting the Palestinian cause. I'm what? How? I lived in the U.S. since the end of 2009, and I would say I'm more Americanized, and I've always been against people who try to silence you by force. I'm for freedom of thought and freedom of speech. So that didn't sit well with me. And I just felt like the more and more they pushed it. And I remember I told him, I said, listen, if I delete the picture, I will just look like an idiot because I posted the picture and then I deleted it. It will look like I have a weak character that I cannot even make up my mind or, you know, make informed decisions. I said, I'm never going to delete that picture. Like, it just makes me look bad after I posted it. I said, so, you know, like the best thing I can do is like, maybe say I don't support, like make another post, say, hey, I didn't mean anything political. I don't support Israeli policies. Like, yeah, we will write that statement for you and then you will post it. And then they wrote the, you know, full statement and saying, I don't support Israeli policies in the Middle East and I support the Palestinian people, da, da, da. And I posted it. And I'm not going to lie to you, right after I finished like Miss Universe and I was done with Miss Iraq, I deleted that picture because even that picture, it was not me. It was them. It was the Miss Iraq organization and it was the Iraqi government, you know, the Minister of Tourism and whatnot, like who is responsible for the Miss Iraq organization. It was their words, not mine.
It doesn't sound like you, so, I must say. It sounds like, you know, when you, God forbid, you see those American pilots taken hostage and then they then support the government of the people that they're hostage to. It sounds a little bit like that, like the post that you made. And for wearing a bikini in a swimsuit competition, you were at the end of intense anger. You received death threats for that. Yes. Some of us might have congratulated you for doing such a thing. But eventually you were forced to flee your home nation with your family for a new life in the US just before 2018 in December of 2017. All this is actually really quite recent, Sarai.
I was already American citizen. My family had to flee Iraq.
Right.
But what did happen, I'm not allowed to return to Iraq ever. I'll probably be killed in the airport. And now that, you know, the Iraqi have took away my citizenship and now that they have criminalized, they passed this law, you know, where they criminalize anyone who has relation with Israel with death penalty. Yes, I'm dead if I ever step a foot, you know, if not by a crazy Islamist person, then it's literally by the government and by the law. So, you know, that's the tragedy. That's the tragedy. But that should tell you, like, what kind of government does this to their own people? If you have a relationship with a person or if you even communicate with a person living in that country, then you will have a death penalty. What is that? You know?
Yeah. It's
and we are not even at war with Israel. When we were ever at war with Israel, the last time we were at war with Israel is literally when Saddam attacked Israel and bombed them, like back in 1990, I think, or something, you know.
But I don't think actually Israel retaliated. That was when the Scuds were going over in the 91 Gulf War.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we actually never went to war with Israel. Absolutely no reason.
No, Israel made a specific point not to retaliate at that point. So, mm-hmm. Sarai, you know, there's a sadness as well to not be able to go back to your country of birth in some ways. But let's just take it back to the beginning. You were born and raised there in Baghdad. Your parents, as you mentioned, from Babylon and Qadisiya, respectively. Mm-hmm. I've got the pronunciation right.
So my mother is from Qadisiya. Yeah, you got it absolutely right. And my dad is from Babylon.
Babylon. And, you know, such a rich culture from Iraq. I had the privilege of interviewing and playing some of the music of Carol Isaacs, who produced a beautiful animation called The Wolf of Baghdad, which is her Babylonian Jewish background.
I'm immensely proud of being a Babylonian Jew. My heritage runs deep, and I'm proud of where my people came from and what they achieved. And I look at my parents and how they left everything, you know, my family, they had to literally leave everything and just be removed, be transplanted somewhere else. And God bless them. I mean, both my parents, they looked forward. They didn't look back. I mean, that's part of it as well. They didn't want to talk about it. And they talked a little bit about the good stuff, but they never spoke about the bad experiences that they had. And it was only through my going back and interviewing my family for this book, my family so generously gave me their time and their stories, and they delved deep and they told me stuff that I never knew. I was shocked by quite a lot of it.
And you learnt English at a very young age. You listened to Western pop music as a kid. So did you always feel that your life would lead you beyond your Baghdadi contours, that you were destined for a life beyond Iraq?
Yes. Yes, to be honest with you. And this is something I felt since I was a child, like as early as I remember. I did not agree with a lot of things that happened in my country, you know, in the culture, in the life that we had. Like, I felt like my future was like planned for me by other people, and that I had to do this and that. And I didn't want to. And I wanted to explore the world. I was curious. I was like, I wanted to travel. I wanted to see. And, even as a kid, I really didn't get along with, kids in school. Like, I had issues, because it's just the culture. Many, it's really sad to say, listen, there are absolutely beautiful things about Iraq, but there are also some things I don't like it, which is, we do have some violence, when you are a child, like the child is really kind of overlooked or not listened to because you're a child, so your voice doesn't matter. So as a child, I just felt no one paid attention to me, and what I said didn't matter, even though I think I was a very smart child for my age. But, I didn't like that. So I felt like, what is going on? And then when I was 13 and the U.S. came in, and then all of a sudden, I remember the U.S. soldiers, like I would, stop and try to talk to them. They were so sweet. They gave us like candy, and they were playing with us, talking to us. I'm like, those are such nice people, and because usually like the adults, they don't pay attention to the kids. Yeah.
Yeah, you got attention from the American soldiers as a child.
I got attention, yeah. Like, I used to play soccer with them, and, they even, it's so funny, like, I swear, this is like Alice in Wonderland. If you lived in Iraq in that moment, like, I remember they were even staying, like, especially right at the beginning of the invasion, they were staying in the amusement park. They were operating the Ferris wheel, and they were operating all the game for us. So imagine like a soldier sitting there with his helmet operating the Ferris wheel for a bunch of children. Like, this is our life. And there was a tank waiting outside the amusement park. Yeah. So it's like very crazy. Alice in Wonderland. But then like we had the satellites, and we were in this, before that, life was like being in North Korea. We didn't know what was going on in the outside world. And after that, all of a sudden, I'm watching American like movies, TV shows, music. And the more and more I saw and learned, I loved it. And I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I would have like much more happiness if I had that freedom and that, and if I could plan my own life. And I fell in love with music. And the time of the civil war in Iraq that followed the invasion, it was very tough. And this is when Iraq became very radicalized and Islamist. They held ground, and they were basically I remember that's the first time I was forced to wear hijab, and my mom had to wear hijab, and like my sisters. So you can imagine why I wanted to get out of there, right? Because we were more secular under Saddam. And I listened to music, and I felt like music was my only escape, because I listened to it and I just feel free. And I forget about the war outside. I forget about the bombing, the suicide bombing, the car bombs, the IEDs, the snipers, all the things that's going on.
Press the subscribe button. Scroll back for ex-Foreign Affairs and Diplomatic TV correspondent, now best-selling author Tim Marshall, on the power of geography.
Basically, we just really need to try as hard as we can to understand the other side and seek to seek to make compromises. I'll leave you with that. I actually think compromise is a beautiful word.
Danny, the Mossad commander, and the extraordinary story of the Red Sea spies.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that because this is something I know, but I think I never told anybody.
Danny, this is very, very beautiful, and this is really going to be an extraordinary interview.
And the inside story on the making of Fauda.
It's a special unit, very special unit, that actually Israel created in order to avoid mass casualties. You have to go inside a difficult and a crazy places in order to pick and to take just one terrorist instead of bombing a whole neighborhood or something like that. So you risk your life in order to do that. You have to be an amazing actor because you're going to be an undercover and you have to go inside the territories with different language, different body language, different clothes, different smell, everything. You have to be an amazing actor and a very cool guy.
So indeed, it was the fact that you learnt English at such a young age and it gave you an opportunity to follow your new American friends, to be a translator for the US military at the age of 18. And you also joined the US-led coalition forces stationed around your home city in Baghdad in 2009. And that job allowed you to help people and the US government reduce the gap between the two cultures. And it gave you a good deal of experience in interacting with people from different backgrounds and high profile individuals at an early age. The irony of that is, in fact, that though they wanted you to try and bridge gap between them and you, actually it was you bridging the gap between you and them, in fact.
That is true, because, you know, they don't understand the Iraqi culture. And I remember I was explaining everything to them. I'm like, no, you can't say this. This is an insult. If they do this, like, you have to do that. Like, I would explain, like, to my commanders and the soldiers that I worked with. But it was literally give and take relationship. I taught them how to communicate with my people. And I also learned about how they communicate with people. And at the same time, the military gave me a lot, because I came from my parents' house. I'm, you can say, a spoiled kid. Like, I didn't have experience in the real world. Like, I didn't. It was my first job in the military. Taught me discipline, taught me, like, to respect, you know, and, like, and to be more reasonable. Like, everything, like, you know, you kind of have to detach your feelings a lot. And I did sometimes, and other times I didn't when it was right. And thank God, you know, but, like, you have to be very reasonable. You know, you have to be, like, a big picture, basically. But no, like, thank God, like, my time in the military taught me so much until today. You know, it made me grow as a person and really become an adult, you know, at such young age.
Do you know what, Sarai? I'm listening to that and it's so fascinating. And music really was your frequency of mobility. It was the frequency by which you were able to move to the United States, to start working, going to school. You graduated from the Musicians Institute in Performance Arts in Hollywood and LA with an emphasis on jazz and contemporary music. That fascinates me because this microphone, this ability to talk to people using this recording machine is my mobility. I thank God that I have this capacity, this ability to be able to talk to people all over the world, eminent people with amazing stories, that gives me a mobility that opens doors and access to me. And it sounds like music did that for you. Tell me how you ended up in Hollywood. How did that happen?
I'll tell you. So basically, you know, I told you, like, I wanted to work with the US when I was in Iraq, and I was thinking I wanted to become a musician and I wanted to go, you know, like, I wanted to travel the world and all of that. And then I remember when I came to the US, I ended up in Arizona, where my friend used to live, and she was a translator with me in Iraq. And I stayed with her for a week maybe, and then I had to flee, because I remember I stepped out from the airport in Tucson and it was so hot. And I said, no. I said, I did not leave Iraq to come to another Iraq. Like, if you lived in Iraq, our heat is unbearable. And like, I've been, since I was a kid, in love with the rain because I rarely get to see the rain in Iraq. And I wanted to go somewhere where it rains a lot. And literally,
come to England, we'll swap for a while.
Yes. Oh, I love England for that. I love England for that. But you know, no, I loved like, you know, green nature, like water, because Iraq was mostly desert, you know? So I wanted something with life, more life and more bearable weather, you know? So I left and then I went to Texas where majority of my military buddies, you know, that I worked with when I was in Iraq, they were all there. So I'm like, I'm going to go to a place where I know people, right? Because you got to start somewhere where you know someone. You know, it's very difficult, like moving on my own to the United States at 19. So I went to Texas and I got a job and I was living in uptown Dallas. And I remember one day, basically, I just snapped. And I was thinking, what the hell am I doing here in this city, doing this job? What am I doing with my life? Because it's like such a culture and different like change for me. And I remember when I came to the US, I was worried. I'm like, ooh, I shouldn't be running out of money. I need to get a job as soon as possible. I need to work. I need to, you know, and I'm on my own. And I remember my family, you know, my family were not really on board. They did, you know, they didn't want to part with me. They didn't want me to come to the US. They're like, no, stay with us. And they said, listen, if you go, you're on your own. The money you saved from working with the US military, that's what you're going to spend. So I went with only $10,000 on me. And I was like freaking out. I'm like, I need to get a job. So I got the job and I was working. But then I realized like 7 months in or 6 months in, I was unhappy. And I remember I told my boss, I said, I need to go home. And I went home and I just sat down and I'm like, think about it. Why did you want to come here? Why did you take that leap, leaving Iraq and coming to the United States? And I'm like, music. This is literally why. And I remember I went online and I was looking at two schools and I had Berkeley came in Boston. And then I had Musicians Institute coming up in California. And I looked at them and I said, you know what? Like Boston is too cold. California is actually beautiful. Let me go to California. And I hopped on an airplane. I didn't know a single person in California. And I came by myself and I went to Musicians Institute and I applied, you know, and got in. And everything else was history.
It's amazing what's happened to you. This courage, this will to follow your dreams, to pursue your hobbies, your ambitions. And like me, you've also had the privilege of working with Hillel Neuer in Geneva for UN Watch. Mm-hmm. It strikes me, Sarai, that everything you do has a definitive purpose, a message built upon your own experience. You've said some incredibly powerful words in the chamber of human rights in Geneva about horrific human rights abuses in Iraq, the murder of citizens who are merely protesting for running water, electricity, and other things that, you know, we take for granted, the assassination of respected public figures, including women, and the mass migration of people who are refugees, just wanted a better life from where they came from.
I am Sarah Edam, Miss Iraq 2017. Representing my people on the world stage is a mission I take seriously. 6 million Iraqis have been displaced due to conflict since 2014. Several factors, including those addressed by the report in paragraphs 30 to 32, may explain migration from my country. Iraqi security forces in Basra are killing protesters who merely demand clean drinking water, electricity, and an end to corruption. Iraqi migrants are fleeing terrible living conditions, ongoing terror attacks, and assassination of public figures, especially women. Assyrian, Yazidis, and other minorities are oppressed. Iraq, which was known as the cradle of civilizations, has now become a graveyard for ethnic and religious diversity. Iraqi migrants believe that their government show more loyalty to Iran than its own people. It names streets after Khomeini, who murdered hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. I ask the UN, why has this council never adopted a single resolution for the human rights of the Iraqi people? How could you elect a government that oppresses its own people as a world guardian of human rights? Thank you.
Thank you. I've been informed that some delegations want to exercise their right of reply. Iraq, thank you for giving me a right of reply to answer unreliable information, not in line with the noble goals of this organization. They seem to be mixing up the victim and the henchman. Iraq guarantees all its citizens the right to peaceful assembly and expression. We have not one single detainee in our prisons detained because of their opinion. Thank you.
Sarai, you represent a lot of hope for literally millions of people. And I'm not just talking about Iraqi Muslims here. I'm talking about Jewish people as well.
I hope so. You know, like I just try to... wherever I see like there is injustice and something that, you know, I feel like could change for the better, like I think we need, you know, we should try to do something.
You describe yourself as not very religious, but more a spiritual and secular Muslim, and perhaps even more eye-openingly, it's there on your bio with a hashtag, you're a proud Zionist. I mean, were you always instinctively a Zionist, perhaps even before you knew what the word was? Is there something that's really just come about because of that extraordinary moment with Miss Universe in 2017? You know, in your heart, perhaps, before you knew anyone who was Jewish?
The word Zionist, I'll tell you this. The word Zionist, I was totally against it when I heard it. I remember the first time I got called a Zionist by an Egyptian person. He said, you're a Zionist. I said, I'm not a Zionist. Like, you're a Zionist. And I didn't know what Zionist meant, literally. So when I heard it, because I heard it my whole life, and it was like a derogatory term, and it's something awful. And this is what I was taught. You know, Zionism is like a racist movement. It hates people. It's evil. It's this and that. And I didn't understand that what Zionism was. It's simply believing Jewish people deserve to have a homeland. That's it. That's literally it. So, no, after I understood the meaning, you know, I started saying proudly, yes, I'm a Zionist. And like, and I felt embarrassed at one moment that I didn't know what it meant, you know?
Sarai, as we say in Hebrew and across the Jewish world, kol hakavod to you, which is a great compliment, a great spirit to you. We're seeing the biggest rocket attacks from Lebanon, the biggest since 2006. Do you think Israel's enemies are mistaken that the nation might be weaker given the internal turmoil of the judicial reforms?
To be honest with you, no, I don't think so. I think it's probably this. They do this every Ramadan. They do this every Ramadan. And they do it on purpose because they know this is the time where Muslims have to fast and have to get closer to God. So they're, you know, Muslim instincts, they kick in and they feel like, oh, I got to do better because this is the time where you repent, the time where you're trying to get close to God. So they know this is a perfect time to try to make you feel like, oh, look, they're killing your brothers and sisters who are Muslim. Say something. If you don't say, they know. It's such manipulation and such cheap trick, and it's really sad, but like I expect nothing better from those type of people. You know, everyone who knows Hezbollah, who knows Hamas, anyone who knows any radical Islamist or an Islamist, they know those people hate their own. They hate even Muslims. They kill us, they hurt us. So all of a sudden, once they do this, the only question I always wonder, and when I see people, they keep falling for it, like, you know who Hezbollah are, you know who Hamas are, why all of a sudden you're buying into this propaganda, you know? And I think this is where literally the person who's believing that, it's their damn fault, I will say this, because they are being biased. And if they know they're being biased, if you see a video, go and look for the full context. If you see something happen, like for me, listen, like it's like, for example, you saw like Trump is going to court. You're going to go and look and see why is Trump is going to court, right? And it's the same thing. If you saw like, you know, Hezbollah fired or the IDF retaliated, ask yourself what led to these events. And it's usually with Hezbollah, with Hamas, there's literally no reason. They just pick a time of the year and they do it. And we've seen them, they do this over and over. And when people, when they say, oh, you know, like the IDF or the security, Israeli security forces, they stormed Al-Aqsa. They were, you know, like arresting people, firing at people. I'm like, yeah, why don't they do this like all year? Why didn't they do this yesterday? You know, that's the question. Any person with intelligence, you know, should ask themselves. And it's just really sad they don't ask that. Like, yes, if Israel hated Muslims and didn't want Muslims inside Al-Aqsa, like, you know, like, why would they could be doing this every day. Why right now? Ask yourself that. And they don't even, you know, they don't even put any effort into researching to see how many hundred thousands enter Jerusalem, enter Al-Aqsa at this time because of Ramadan. And this is the time where Israel makes an exception and let hundred thousands of people come to pray. So I do blame the people for their ignorance. They need to, if they were sincere, if they were speaking the truth, they would look at both sides and they would research before they open their mouth.
Sarah, your words are very brave. They are counterintuitive to much of the narrative in the Muslim world. If there were more Sarai Idans to speak out in the same way that you do, the chances of war and conflict would become lesser with every person that spoke out. So what is your message to your co-religionists about the extremist manipulation of your religion and its greatest festival?
I think, you know, like if I have like a message like to other Muslims, I would just remind them that we are a religion of billions, not millions, billions. We control so many lands, not just in Asia and Africa, like all over the world, we have Muslims. And literally what we have with Israel and Palestine, it's kind of like an obsession. And you know, when I see it, I never understand it, because literally there are Muslims being killed and raped right now by the Iranian regime. There are Muslims being oppressed in Iraq, you know, Sunni Muslims being displaced, hundred thousands of them actually in Iraq being displaced right now by the Iraqi government, and the people are quiet. There are Muslims in Chinese prison, like the Uyghur, and they're being tortured in concentration camps. And you are quiet, but your obsession with Israel, it literally comes down to this, that who's oppressing or who you think is oppressing Muslims is Jews. And you are furious because it's Jewish people. This is what plays in your head. So sorry to say this, this shows hypocrisy. And it's basically you're saying if other Muslims torture other Muslims, it's fine. But if it's Jews, then it's not okay. And it's not even that. And that's the sad part. There's no torture. There's literally just people trying to reach coexistence with their with the Palestinian population. They're trying to create two states. And your obsession and your defense mechanism, like how you're defending yourself and all of that, is not helping. It's not helping create peace. It's been like 71 years. We haven't reached anything. And I think it's time you follow through, like, you know, UAE are doing so much better, like Bahrain and Morocco, all these countries. We need to join in, but also we need to push it even further than that. You know, like sadly, for example, you know, just today I messaged one of my Emirati friends. He posted two things. One of them was a statement from the Emirati government that said they condemn the violence that happened inside Al-Aqsa. And again, you can see who started this, you know, this situation in Al-Aqsa. You can see it was Hamas and extremists starting attacking people in trying to create the situation. And of course, when you start with violence, the situation is going to end with violence. You have to stop the people who started the violence. And that's normal. And I could only imagine, you know, this is like also some hypocrisy in there, because imagine if you had any group doing that inside Emirates, imagine what would happen. I can tell you what would happen. Those people would be executed, not just arrested, not just like literally executed. So you talk about violence and you condemn the violence, but you have even more oppressive methods when you have people who try to challenge your authority and try to harm innocents and citizens. So when I see that, I get angry. And the other thing that I saw, you know, like another post of the same person, which was literally, they said, oh, there were hundreds of thousands of Israelis who were protesting and the IDF did not stop them. And like the Israeli security forces did not stop them, but you're only applying aggression to Palestinians when they protest. And I messaged the person. I said, are you kidding me? I said, first of all, the people inside Al-Aqsa did not protest. They were attacking. They were rioting. I said, did you see hundreds of thousands of Israeli rioting? There was not a single riot in Israel. That's the difference. If the Israelis rioted, if they were harming innocent citizens, then yeah, they would face the same violence and aggression by the security forces. So, you know, when I see things like that, it's so stupid. It's so hypocritical. You know, I have to say something. So I just want to remind my Arab and my Muslim friends, and they know this very well, that you need to apply the same kindness that you apply to yourself to Israelis, and understand when there's a threat to the public, you can't be quiet. You can't be nice about it. And you would have dealt with it much worse. So stop lecturing Israelis on how they handle the rioters. That's all I have to say.
Sarah, you've said it with grace and with clarity. And just before we go, I have one question for you. Are you still in touch with Enrique Iglesias?
I'm still in touch. Listen, when I met him twice, and he was like so sweet. And, you know, to me and to my mom and my sisters and brothers, we all went to see him. And no, I'm still in touch, actually, with his band. His drummer and his pianist, both of them, they're good friends of mine. They follow me. They like my posts. They follow everything that I'm doing. And I actually haven't talked to them in a while. Maybe I should reach out and say, hey, is Enrique playing?
Hey, Enrique. It's Sarai. I've all grown up now. Because I think what we should tell the audience is that back in 2007, while you were a refugee in Syria, we should say that you escaped there with your family for a few years to avoid the civil war in Iraq. You went to a live concert that Enrique gave in Damascus. And it was at that moment. That's the moment. That's why we're talking about music all the way up.
Yes, that's true. I remember. That was the moment, I would say that was the first moment in my life where I was truly happy, because I lived years, you know, of oppression and war in Iraq and seen nothing but violence. Then I go to Syria, and I remember with the first hit of the drums and the guitar and the music, the power, the beauty and the power of music that I heard, I transformed and I forgot about all the pain, all of my sadness, and I was this happy person jumping up and down and feeling nothing but happiness, you know. And that's the power of music. So this is why, you know, it's divine. This is why I love it. This is why I've done a lot for it.
Sarai, this has been a wonderful conversation, and it's one that's even exceeded my expectations of you, which were very high in the first place. And I want to thank you for your time and for joining me in this very, very special episode and conversation with you here on Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This is, you know, it's an important episode. I'm doing very big things with my podcast. It's reaching out to the world. As I say, it's a Jewish media which looks out to the world, not in. And so it's very important for me to have, you know, some of the world's most important people, Jewish and non-Jewish, to talk about perspectives of peace and justice, which just are not repeated on the media around the world. And you certainly help in doing that, as Emily has, as Hillel has in my episode. So I, again, I'm very grateful and thank you for doing this.
No, of course. You know, it's good to have allies. And I hope, you know, this episode, I hope it will get the attention like to the podcast. I hope it was a good episode. Yeah, and let me know if you ever, you know, need anything. Like, I'm here.
That's very kind of you. That's really kind of you. Thank you very much indeed.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. At ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould. Johnny Gould's Jewish State is brought to you with Dangor Education.